What's up, everybody? Welcome to the Student Loan Planner Podcast. Today, you have myself, Megan, and Dan. Today, we're going to be talking about a few different things, but I wanted to start with some exciting news about one of our team members, Molly. Molly is one of our student loan planner consultants, and she recently welcomed her first baby boy into the world on Tuesday, the 21st. His name is Steven. So she will be out of the office for a little bit, taking care of herself and her baby and this new family that she has. So we're super excited for Molly, but wanted to start off with some really fun, exciting student loan family news. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what we're going to get into today, Dan?
Yeah, so we're going to talk about the results of the Supreme Court case on cancellation. I'm just kidding. We're actually recording this. We're recording this before the 28th of February. By the time this comes out, you guys will know more than we do. So what we're actually going to talk about today is what you can do outside of that. You know, we can talk about the new revised pays you earn plan, the new Biden plan. We've been calling it new repay. See if that's a good plan for you. I think normally people are going to figure that out in a consult, but we can talk about it big picture. Also, 1098E tax forms. A lot of people who did consolidations last year got those just at the beginning of the year and are maybe wondering what to do with them, if they can do anything with them. And then some stories from our email inbox.
Perfect. I think we've got a nice lineup. Let's kick it off with just talking about the Supreme Court case coming up. So this is a very anticipated event because of all the news and the excitement about cancellation last year that abruptly came to a halt and was frozen until this Supreme Court hearing coming up. So February 28th, that's going to be probably the day this comes out. There's going to be some conversations on the cancellation. So just as a refresher, this was a $10,000 or $20,000 student loan cancellation of really anybody who had federal student loans, as long as they fell below the income thresholds, which was $125,000 for a single individual or $250,000 for married couples or head of households. And the $20,000 of cancellation was available if you had at any point received a Pell Grant in your education, pursuing your education. You could tell if you did by looking at your studentaid.gov account, and it'll tell you your balance and any grants that you had through your aid. So that's a surefire way to check. So this should be interesting. We're going to see if the Supreme Court is probably going to be turning this down pretty quickly. There's going to be a lot of coverage on it, and I think we'll start to get some hints from the judges' comments and questions during those oral arguments. And I think it will be giving us some clues. This is from Travis's email last week, too. I think he thinks we're going to get a lot of clues next week on how this case is going to go. So to be determined, we will have more information on this to come, but we are really close to getting some closure on what this is going to look like. And then we can move on to other things, to other planning things. So,
yeah, other planning things that I think people should be focused on, whether or not this $10,000 or $20,000 happens for them. And for a lot of our borrowers, $10,000 of cancellation would be great, but it's a feel good for a lot. If you have $300,000 in student loans and it goes down to $290,000, that's a feel good. If you have $30,000 in student loans and it goes down to $20,000 or $10,000, that's life changing. And I think that for us and for a lot of the people that we talk to, figuring out which income-driven plan you're going to be on in the future is big. And with this new Biden plan, we're calling it new repay because it's replacing old repay from 2014, figuring out if the new Biden plan is a good plan for you. And because it allows you, unlike old repay, to file married filing separately and exclude your spouse's income, is that a good plan to prepare for this tax season?
Yeah, we're in the midst of tax season. So this is a really hot topic question right now. Is it something that you should do in anticipation of this new plan or not? And I think the answer is it depends, right? That's always the answer with any of our planning that we do. So depends on a lot of factors. One big factor that should be considered, and this all comes around with timing. I think a lot of the things we're going to talk about is timing, and timing for every individual and their student loans might be a little different than the other person. So timing when it comes to income recertification. So considering filing taxes separately, first and foremost, let me say, this is only if you're married. So if you're single, you can tune this conversation out. If you are married and you're getting ready to file your 2022 taxes, then I think the first thing you want to think about is, does filing taxes separately, is that going to make a difference? Now, it's going to make a difference potentially if your spouse has income. If your spouse is not an income earner, it may not make sense to be filing taxes separately unless you're in a community property state. That's one of the 9 states that divide income between the 2 spouses on their tax return. So that's states like California, Washington State, Idaho, Nevada, New Mexico, Texas, Louisiana, randomly Wisconsin. It's up there. So the 9 community property states, that is where we have the breadwinner loophole that we do some planning around when it comes to filing taxes separately. Because if, just as a refresh, if you're the breadwinner, you're earning, let's say, $200,000, your spouse is a homemaker, stays at home, does not have income, you file taxes separately in California, let's just say, on your tax return, it's going to show your income as $100,000 and it's going to show your spouse's as $100,000. So that's a significant benefit to being in a community property state if you are the breadwinner, because it makes your income look less, which will make your income-driven plan look a little bit less. So first question to ask yourself if you're married is, you know, is it actually going to make a difference to be filing separately? If your spouse does not earn income, you're not in a community property state, then you don't need to be considering this. Now, if your spouse has loans as well, this gets a little tricky because filing taxes separately may or may not be beneficial. The new repay rules are really interesting in how it's going to be counting family size. So there are some reasons to maybe be considering filing separately, even if you and your spouse have student loans. So that's something that's definitely a little more tedious than what we can get into on a conversation here today, but that's something that we assess when we're looking at your plan, when we do our consultations. But recertification, I know that's also a big factor in this timing decision, right?
Yeah, this year's special. Like last year, we're just changing with the student loan environment. And this tax season, it might, if you're married, still make sense to file married filing jointly. Let's put ourselves in the shoes of you as a borrower. And if you were on an income-driven plan going into the pandemic freeze, so you were on pay-as-you-earn or revised pay-as-you-earn or income-based repayment going into the pandemic freeze before March 13th of 2020, and you haven't updated your income or recertified on that plan, then your payment is probably based off of prior year income. So maybe it was based off of 2018 income even.
2018 or 2019 maybe, which is still a long time ago now.
Yeah, 2018 or 2019 income. That's crazy. So you have this payment based off of income from that year. And if you do nothing going into this payment freeze ending this summer, then your payment is going to continue at that payment. And it's going to continue at that payment until you're required to recertify. If you go to studentaid.gov, it says that no one's going to be required to recertify until at least 6 months after the pause ends. And the pause ends currently June 30th. So let's just pretend that it's your first payment starts in July. It's based off of 2018 or 2019 income, and that you have to recertify in January. You could file your tax return, however saves you the most on taxes, say it's jointly. And when you file jointly this tax season, next January, you recertify and you make a payment based off of your joint income. Now, if you were intending to file separately to exclude spouse's income, you could file your next tax return a couple months later. You'll have paid a couple months of higher payments from filing jointly, and then you can utilize that next tax return to recalculate your payment. Now, if your file on studentaid.gov says that your anniversary date is actually, or your loan servicer, let's use your loan servicer, says that your income-driven repayment anniversary date is this October. Well, studentaid.gov says that if your date falls between now and 6 months after the pause ends, then it's pushed out by 12 months. So someone like that, who, where their loan servicer says your anniversary date for recertifying for your income-driven plan is this October, it's actually October of 2024. So you can file jointly, continue to have a payment based off of 2018 or 2019 income all the way until October of 2024. And at that point, you'll use your 2023 tax return, which you filed next spring.
Yeah. So all of this comes down to timing. It's if switching to repay makes sense, it comes down to timing on when you need to switch. If recalculating your payment is necessary because you filed jointly previously and you're going to be filing separately in the future, timing comes into play. So it's, I'm feeling that, I'm seeing that in our consultations lately, where of course it's important to talk about which repayment route is going to be the best way to go. This year, I feel like especially timing is very important because we are still kind of in limbo on exactly when payments are going to kick back in, maybe a little bit in limbo on exactly when your income recertification is going to be. Although I think we can make some educated guesses with that guidance from studentaid.gov. And so it's mapping out the path to saving you the most money can get kind of nitty gritty into the dates here coming up.
You know, Megan, I just thought of a new situation. Let's say that you graduated during the pandemic and you're married now and you've never been on an income-driven plan and you're a recent follower to the Student Loan Planner podcast, or maybe you're a longtime follower, but let's say that the other parts are true. You graduated after the pandemic freeze from grad school, you're married now, and you're not in an income-driven plan yet. And you know, the first thing I'd say is book a consult so you can just verify this information, make sure that it's going to work out. But here's the situation I'm putting a layup in for. That is, spouse does not work, and you live in a community property state, like Megan was mentioning earlier, and you're thinking about getting on an income-driven plan because you want to pursue public service loan forgiveness or even long-term loan forgiveness. Is the new revised pay as you earn plan a good fit for you, or is a different plan a good fit for you? That's what you can determine at a consult. But how it, getting into, let's say you determine I'm going to be on the new Biden plan. That plan allows you to file separately and exclude spouse's income. If spouse doesn't have income and you're in a community property state, then use half of your income, essentially. You do want to file married filing separately, probably this tax season, so that you can enter the new Biden plan this summer, if it's available. You know, and if it's not available, you could enter a different plan. So there might be a really good reason to file married filing separately this tax season. We were just talking about a good reason to file jointly because you don't have to recertify later, but you're not on a plan. There might be a really good reason to file separately this tax season.
Yes. Yeah. No, that's a good point. And I think another situation that I have been seeing too in my consultations is folks that are on income-based repayment and they have been filing taxes separately to exclude spousal income. So income-based repayment is not the cheapest income-driven plan. But if you don't have access to pay as you earn right now or new IBR, which allows you to exclude spousal income with how the plans operate currently, then IBR is the next best option. It keeps your payment off of just your own income. Even if it's 15% of your own income, it's cheaper than maybe 10% of your household income on the existing repay plan. So folks who are on IBR, income-based repayment, who are anticipating maybe this new repay plan being a lot better for them because it's now potentially going to allow you to exclude spousal income and make your payment a lot cheaper with the same forgiveness timeline, 25 years, then those folks are ones that we're recommending, hey, it probably still makes sense to continue with filing taxes separately in anticipation of needing to switch to this plan. Is that always the case? No. Depends on what your IBR payment was. It might be really low and we might want to just keep that locked in payment until you have to make changes or recertify. But if it's something that is going to save you a lot of money to switch to new repay if it comes out, then I think that's another reason to consider separate filings for 2022.
Yeah. So I got an email from Megan's probably also gotten tons of emails about this too. In fact, I went to Megan to ask her about this. So I got an email from a past consult who was like, I've got this 1098E tax form and it says an absurd amount of interest on here. And I know I didn't make these payments and I'm filling in the gaps a little bit, but put yourself in the shoes of someone who isn't used to getting a tax form from their loan servicer. And all of a sudden they do get one. And there weren't any payments made last year. We were in the middle of this freeze. and this tax form has thousands of dollars of interest listed on it. What do you do with a tax form like that? And that's what I asked. I posted in our Slack channel. I was like, hey guys, I don't understand what's going on. Why is there this interest payment when we know there were no interest payments last year?
Yeah, it is confusing because just like you said, we haven't been making payments. There's 0% interest for the COVID forbearance, but a lot of people have been getting these tax forms. And the reason is when you consolidate or combine your federal student loans, what happens is your interest is capitalized. And that means that the accrued interest that was on your balance, that just means interest that hasn't been paid off in the past, that accrued interest is then added to your principal. And your new consolidation loan is that old principal that you had plus the accrued interest. So in their eyes, you have had an impact, or you have technically paid that interest by converting it into a new loan, essentially. And so that is why people are getting those 1098E tax forms, because if you consolidated last year, even though you didn't make any payments, you didn't actually pay out of your pocket interest money, you had a hit from that consolidation in the IRS's eyes because that accrued interest was paid.
Yeah, that seems to me like a new loophole in a way.
It's interesting, right?
Imagine that you're a lower income earner pursuing public service loan forgiveness and consolidated to take advantage of the PSLF waiver or the IDR waiver. And you get this, you had a bunch of this accrued interest tacked onto your balance, and you could get a tax deduction for part of that. That's crazy.
There is a tax deduction. So that form, what it boils down to is they're sending you a form that you report with your tax filings when you prepare your taxes. And it shows how much interest was paid, and up to $2,500 of paid interest is deductible as long as you fall below certain income thresholds and depending on how you file taxes. So if you're a single individual and you make less than about $70,000, then you would be able to take that full deduction of the $2,500. Now, a deduction is not just $2,500 off your taxes. It just reduces your taxable income. So it's probably worth maybe $500 to $600 of tax savings overall. That's what it boils down to. Now, there is a phase out of income if you're single. So if you make between $70,000 and $85,000 as a single individual, you could still deduct a portion of up to that $2,500, but not the full amount. It slowly phases itself out. So maybe instead of saving $500, $600 on taxes, maybe you save like $100, depending on how close you are to the $85,000 being phased out. And then for joint filers, those who are married, $145,000 starts. Anything under $145,000, you get the full deduction. And it phases itself out up to $175,000, where maybe there's a portion that's deducted. Now, if you file taxes married separately, this is not something you can deduct. So that is something that we actually have in our consultations, we have a little married filing separate calculator that it's not, you know, CPA grade, anything like that, but it helps us estimate the potential tax hit that you might experience with filing taxes separately based on the tax brackets and that specific deduction. And so if you're filing separately, it's probably because it's going to make a lot of sense to keep your payments lower to pursue forgiveness, and that $500, $600 isn't really worth filing jointly for. But that is something to be aware of, is if you're filing separately, that's not something you can take. And if you're above those income thresholds, it's not something you can take either.
Yeah, it was never something you could take. Yeah, that's, yeah. I mean, if you're in that, you know, you're single making less than $70,000 and thinking, I can't afford to pay for a student loan consult, and you're thinking maybe the income driven repayment waiver still applies to me. You know, if the result of that conversation is consolidate and there's a student loan interest deduction to take next tax season, then that conversation and the cost of that conversation was paid for by this deduction.
Yeah. Or if you already consolidated last year because you graduated, you thought it was the right thing to do, then you're going to have that tax savings or maybe that refund this tax time. So if you are still concerned about your plan, maybe invest that back into yourself and back into your plan to make sure that you're on track for the student loan side of things. Yeah. And one note that you had put too in our notes, Dan, was that the student loan interest deduction isn't an itemized deduction. So it's, you don't have to be itemizing. You could be taking the standard deduction and still be able to take this. So it's this along with contributing to 401k or 403b, HSA, FSA, those things are all above the line deductions that reduce your adjusted gross income, making your payment on the student loans a little bit less in the future. So it has an impact on in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, for sure. A follow-up question I haven't received on it, but you know, if you're taking that deduction for that year, that's a tax form that's just for that year. If you paid more in interest from your consolidation, or you paid more in interest on your FFEL loans that you didn't consolidate that have continued to have payments and interest accrued during this freeze.
Or private loans.
Yeah. Or private loans. You know, you can take these interest deductions up to that $2,500 cap. And then after that, it's just, that's as much as you can take. There's no rollover, no carryover tax return. It's a once a year thing or once a tax season thing.
Yep. You know, unfortunately that hasn't even raised the $2,500. That's been what it has been for a while. I'm hoping there's maybe some kind of inflation adjustment on that at some point, but there is not currently. It's been $2,500 for a bit. But yeah, I think, and if we're talking about this and it makes you question like, oh, dang, maybe I shouldn't be filing separate to get this. Like, keep in mind, again, it's only worth about $500-$600. Your separate payments, what the payments would be based off of your separate income. The crossover point that we always look for is making sure that the savings we're reaping from filing separately outweigh any negative costs when it comes to filing taxes separately. And it's probably true, depending on your income, of course, that filing separately still makes more sense than trying to go after this smaller deduction. But definitely consult with your tax professional about these for your specific situation. But these are some general ideas of how this works.
Megan and I were talking about this before we recorded it. We're going to share some success stories, just some short stuff. Like every week, we get emails from borrowers that we consulted on in the past with happy updates and some frustrated updates too.
Oh yeah, both.
Frustrated updates, but it's just more a matter of time. So this morning, right before about, I don't know, 15 minutes before this consult was recorded. And if you're listening to the podcast and you recognize these words, then you know who you are. But I got an email that just said, "Hi, Dan, I received notice last week that my student loans were forgiven. Thank you so much for your help." So
awesome.
Those kinds of emails make my day, make my week, just keep us doing what we're doing. 2 days ago, I got one saying, "Exciting news," and the subject line, and it was 4 exclamation marks.
All caps.
"I'm excited to tell you that with your guidance, my loans were discharged via PSLF waiver. And then later on, my loan amount forgiven was $515,000 and change."
Wow, that is awesome. So there was definitely some kind of forgiveness sweep that happened in the past couple of days, as I think we could tell based on how many emails we've been getting. So that's exciting. If you have been waiting and waiting and waiting, like if you've had the 120 qualifying payments or more reflecting in your MOHELA account for a couple of weeks, you may have been on this chunk of people that have gotten loan forgiveness.
Also, 2 days ago, there was one I got that said, "I think my loans just got forgiven. There was a huge cluster after my servicer changed to MOHELA, right? I was about to be forgiven in August." So this is for a consult. And well, I guess the last of it was, I'm just sitting here in shock. And I think the process is actually finally over. I've spent the last 11 years about my student loans. Yeah. So when we talked, I remember this consult. This was back in May or June. Well, not before August. Like a lot of these consults were from the April, May, June, July timeframe, and people that had already reached 120 or were near it, the timeline.
Yeah, that's pretty wild. And that goes to show that the timeline has been grossly long for people, even people who had all their ducks in a row, like submitting their documentation, you know, because there was a lot of change. Like if your loans were at Fed Loan last year, they had to get moved over to MOHELA, which may have delayed the loans actually getting forgiven, even if you were over 120 payments, because they had to get MOHELA's ducks in a row over there. And then the PSLF waiver came through. tons of applications getting submitted, tons of processing for the new Mohila loan servicer and FedLoan trying to finish out what they already had. So, I mean, people really and literally have been waiting. Yeah, I think originally we were thinking, oh yeah, it'll take 2 to 4 months to get some correspondence on your loan details and your forgiveness. Now we hesitate to say like 6 months because it's been taking like 6 to 9 months for some people. Like it's been really wild and it is frustrating. And that's a lot of what we do get a lot of emails from people saying, hey, when can I expect something? And it's tough because we don't know. We can't control it, unfortunately. We just can tell like from other clients what their general processing times have been. And even that, even going off of one person's processing time isn't super accurate for what someone else's processing time might look like. So it's been, it's funny. We get like the hot and cold emails. It's like, hooray, I got my loans forgiven. And then the next email is like, hey, I'm still sitting at 118 payments. When are the other two going to get added? It's like, because I had a lot this past week too come through from clients who had literally been emailing me. And I love you guys. I do. I love you guys. But you had emailed me probably every week, if not every other week, about your payment counts. And I kept saying, be patient. And you probably thought I'm crazy saying that over and over again, but it really was. Like I knew we had our ducks in a row for this forgiveness and it was just a matter of time for them to get to your file. But I had this person email me from a consult back in 2020, actually. You first advised me back in 2020 after a long stint in purgatory. I saw the smiley face of forgiveness on my Mohila account today, and my balance is zero, over 190,000 forgiven. I would likely never have gotten this far, or if I did, I would not have had the confidence you and Student Loan Planner gave me. Thank you for your excellent advice. Thanks to SLP, the podcast, Travis, the newsletter. I really don't think it's completely hit me yet, but I for sure wanted to thank you. And that was a medical librarian with no student loan debt. So yeah.
That's feel good. And I feel like a lot of these consults, I'm coming in as just the gatekeeper at the end. Like you've been following us, those of you listening for years or following Travis's email, or maybe you've done a consult in the past, you booked a follow-up consult with Megan or myself, especially me. Megan's been around here longer. I feel like I'm just the person at the end, like cheering you on.
Yeah, that's kind of what it feels like. And I know like probably if you are still listening to this podcast, that means that your loans have not been forgiven yet, even if you are probably already there. I want to say to you specifically, as long as you know that you've had your ducks in a row. And what I mean by that is you've submitted your employment certification forms. Maybe they've already sent you an email update about what your payment counts are. And maybe that panicked you because they said you only had 4 payments out of the 120 or whatever the count is. Don't worry. This is taking a long time for almost everybody. You are not being singled out. But I think if you've gotten that documentation submitted, maybe you had a consultation with us in the past and you're just waiting, have faith, this will work out. It's taking some time. And if you're concerned, if you haven't worked with us or you don't have a planner like Dan or I to email and bug about your progress, make a consultation if you're unsure or if you're worried about your situation, because it's better to know than to have missed something and have that be the downfall of what you thought was going to be happening here coming up. Not to scare you, but that's a word of caution.
I would also say if you are in our inbox and you're sending us a letter, this is one that I answer probably a couple times a day. So if you have your PDF correspondence from Mohila and it gives you a qualifying payment count, like you've got eligible payments, qualifying payments, and then employment not certified yet, there's usually a paragraph right below the table that says, these include payments counts and employment certifications processed through the date of this letter, and further updates may be processed for your eligible and qualifying payment counts. As long as that asterisk and that paragraph is there, operate under the assumption of they're not done yet.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And thank you for reading that too, because that's what I've been telling folks too. Like that paragraph is relevant. That is true. They're sending multiple payment count updates, not one, not two, sometimes not even three, but four or five updates for however they're batching their payment counting. Still not sure how they're doing it, but the payment counts will make more sense the more time goes on. And thankfully, we are not in repayment right now. So we do have time before payments resume. So it's likely that they'll get to you before payments kick back in. And I'm sure that that's what their goal is to try to get all that processing done before they have to turn payments back on, because then it's going to get busier for them. And they know now is the time to get stuff done, right?
Now's the time to get it done. Now, if we do fast forward and you do have to make payments, but you're pretty sure you're already there, make the payments, because any payments made after that determined 120th date, 120th month date, as long as they were direct loans, you know, and you have direct loans if you're going for PSLF, any over extra payments are treated as overpayments.
And you'll get those refunded. Yep. So there's no downside. You know, it may stink coming out of pocket for a couple months if they're really delayed, but you will get that money back if you have to pay and before you get your loans forgiven. That's in regards to the PSLF waiver. Just one quick note about the IDR waiver. We are starting to see some evidence of them doing some adjustments in people's studentaid.gov account. Adjustments might not be the right word, but they're starting to clean up loan files is what we can tell from what we've been looking at. So their guidance has been saying for the IDR waiver, which is just anyone who's been in repayment, they're going to be counting any repayment periods or certain forbearance periods towards that 20 or 25 year timeline to forgiveness. They're going to have that information handy. Still, it says by July of 2023, studentaid.gov is going to start reflecting an IDR payment tracker, similar to how PSLF has a payment tracker. Thank goodness. That's going to be so awesome. They are supposed to be developing it right now. It's going to be available over the summer, July 2023, for you to be able to get a feel for where you stand in regards to the longer term forgiveness if you're someone in that boat. And for those that have already been paying for 20 or 25 years and you expect the IDR waiver is going to be forgiving your loans, we're getting real close to that too. So I think that you've probably already done this, but if you have those commercial FFEL loans, make sure that those guys are consolidated. We can do that up until May 1st, according to their guidance right now. You've probably already done that though, if you've been listening to this podcast, and it's just kind of a waiting game until that tracker comes out and until that correspondence comes out about your IDR forgiveness path. But that's one note on IDR waiver for those who are not pursuing PSLF.
Yeah, if you're not pursuing PSLF and you do consolidate, remember that that's going to re-trigger your payment. So if you had FFEL loans before and you're consolidating to have direct loans for this IDR waiver, maybe your FFEL loan payment on the income-based repayment plan was some number, it's going to change. So when you do that math to figure out what the payment is, you can go to studentloanplanner.com, go to our calculators, you know, or if you're a new follower on this podcast, go to studentloanplanner.com. Scroll down and subscribe to our email list, that you'll start to get email updates about the IDR waiver as we approach that finish line. But to go back to the consolidation, when you consolidate, you're going to have a new payment. It's going to be based off of the most recent tax return on file or the income documentation, i.e. pay stubs that you give them, one of the two, and just prepare for that payment changing.
Yep. And you're usually, after the consolidation is done, which takes about 30 to 45 days, a week or two after that is when the repayment plan is approved that you applied for. That's typically the timing. So don't be worried if the consolidation says it's done, but you don't know what your payment, what it's going to be yet. That is likely to come shortly after that. They have to get the consolidation done first, then the IDR application second.
That's another hot button topic I feel like ends up in my inbox often is we recommended a consolidation. And then because you're on top of your loans with this consolidation, you're watching it, you're logging into studentaid.gov, you're looking for the loans to show up, your loan servicer. And then all of a sudden your loan servicer says you're on the standard plan.
Yeah. Oh yeah. That's a great point. Yeah. This happens a lot.
It's temporary. You're on the standard plan for now. They still have to. So when you fill out that online consolidation application, you step through that 45-minute process. When you finish the consolidation application, it pre-filled two forms. One of them was the consolidation, and the other one was if you requested to be on an income-driven plan, the income-driven repayment request form. That second form, Megan just mentioned, takes time for them to process. In the meantime, or in the interim, they put you on a plan, and usually it's the standard plan.
Right. Yeah. And for those that also pay very close attention to the letters that you get during that process or the correspondence from the servicer, they'll send you a letter that says, hey, the consolidation is about to be done. And it'll list the different repayment plans that are available within the federal system with your balance and what those payments would be on those repayment plans. But it's not going to list the income-driven plan payments. Why? Because again, that's not the purpose of the consolidation application. That's the next application that you submitted that they haven't processed yet. So I get a lot of panicked emails at first that say, hey, why doesn't it show repay as an option on here? It's because they have to finish that consolidation first. So I think patience and I guess having a little bit of blind faith that the process will shake itself out is necessary when it comes to some of these things, which is challenging, you know, having patience and faith in the student loan system. But for these particular things, that is really what is needed is just, you know, giving it time to process, which we're talking about the government here. So it takes some time for processing. Now, one other hot button topic I wanted to mention, since we are talking about consolidations, I think this is one of the last little notes we had as it goes towards double consolidations. So double consolidations are for our Parent PLUS borrowers out there that are trying to get access to those cheaper income-driven plans through the double consolidation loophole. That's something that we talk about at depth in our YouTube channel on some of our podcast episodes in the past. We have a webinar on YouTube that we did, Lauren and I had done in the past to help talk people through this. Again, this is a process and it does deal with actually three consolidations usually. Usually it's three consolidations. So I joked on a call the other day, I was like, we maybe should have called it the triple consolidation because technically it's three consolidations. We just do it in two processes or two like consolidation rounds, I guess you could say. All that to say, the loan servicers, Dan and I actually ran into this, or you did more so, noticing that addresses had changed for the loan servicers for people who were trying to do a paper consolidation, sending that off. And just a refresher of the process for double consolidations, we start with two paper applications usually, where we break apart the loans, we send some to one company, some to another company, and we have to mail those off because we can only do one online application every 6 months. So we start off with paper, so the last step can be easy and just an online application later. But the addresses, they're on studentaid.gov if you go to the consolidation section. But Dan, you were completely right. Their addresses for some of the loan servicers changed multiple times over the past 12 months, right?
Yeah, they did. And we can put a link to the consolidation page on studentaid.gov in the show notes, I think. But if you go to studentaid.gov and you go to repayment up the top and then loan consolidation, it pulls up the consolidation start page where you could fill out, you know, your consolidation. But if you just scroll down to the bottom, there's a listing of every current loan servicer and they have their addresses there. So if you're filling out a paper application, like going through that double consolidation process, reference that address and mail it to that PO box or that address, you know, each application. And yeah, they changed a few times. I think Ed Financial changed twice since May or April of last year. And that's unfortunate. Well, I guess I'd say check that, reference that, because what you don't want to have happen is your loans end up at the same loan servicer.
Yep. And yeah, and I did actually have a client this week, I think, maybe 2 days ago, send me an email with a picture of their application that they mailed. They were sending it to Mohila by mail, and I had sent them the address because they were one of my consultations that I was helping them with the process. And in the time that I had done the consultation with them and they had mailed off that letter, the address had changed. And thank goodness they sent it certified mail and they had their return address on it because it got sent back to them. And they emailed me and said, hey, what happened? And I look it up and I'm like, sure enough, Mohila's address changed. So I sent him back the correct address and he just has to resend it, which is fine. Another note on this is Great Lakes was one of the loan servicers that we could have used for a double consolidation, but they have been, I think, officially absorbed by Nelnet. So they don't even show up as an option on the page where it lists the consolidation page where it lists all these companies and addresses. So you're going to have to use either Nelnet, Ed Financial, Aidvantage, OSLA Servicing, or Mohila. And one special note is four of the five are processed through Aidvantage. So that panics people because if we say all the time, like you have to send it to different companies, you have to send it to different companies. This still works, even though four of the five companies go through Aidvantage. What is very key, however, is that each of the addresses, you'll see this when you look at this page, it has for Ed Financial, OSLA, and Mohila. They do not process their own consolidations. They use Aidvantage to do that for them. They delegate it to them. So they have the address listed as going to C/O Aidvantage, and then they have a PO box. Each one of those PO boxes are one number off from the other. So they almost look identical except for that one PO box number. So for example, Ed Financial is PO box 30,008. Eight is the last number. And then OSLA is 7, you know, 30,000 with a 7. And OSLA is 30,000 with a 6. So they're one PO box number off from each other, but that is important to note because again, we don't want to send these to the same company. You can complete the double consolidation successfully by using one of these companies still, even though it clears through Aidvantage, they're going to an end result that's different. And that's what's important. We've stress tested this. We've seen this work successfully. So we're not worried about, you know, having to use one of those companies for the double consolidation process.
And a separate note, not related to double consolidation, but consolidation with respect to the IDR waiver. We're recording this in late February, and that IDR waiver effectively expires, you know, before the payment pause ends, right? Around the same time. You have time if you still are, you know, you don't have qualifying loans for the new Biden plan because they're FFPL loans or Perkins loans. If you're looking at doing a consolidation and you have past payment history, when you go to fill that out in the consolidation application, if you got your attorney hat on, you're looking at the promissory note disclosures, it says in there that your payment history in the past doesn't count towards the new loan and doesn't count towards public service loan forgiveness either. But the IDR waiver page on studentaid.gov is a thing that happens after. It's a retroactive adjustment. So if you're, you know, looking at that, filling out the consolidation application and in a moment of seeing that, you experience a moment of panic about, oh, what am I doing here? Why am I consolidating? If you've done a consult with us, you can email us about it. And what we're going to come back with is that IDR waiver page. This is a payment count adjustment done retroactively, done after it. And if you are going to do this consolidation after the IDR waiver is over, then that's a different topic, different timeline, different story.
Yeah, the IDR and PSLF waiver language supersedes the consolidation language currently until that expires, which technically is May 1st for the IDR waiver and some of the benefits of the PSLF waiver that originally expired October 31st. All right. Well, we've really rounded up a variety of different things today. Some happy news with PSLF waiver cancellation or forgiveness that we've been seeing. Some cautionary things with some of the consolidation technicalities and some interesting things with taxes. We covered quite a bit today. Anything else you think we should touch on before we round it out for everybody?
No, I'd say if you don't have a payment right now, but you know you're going to have a payment in a couple months, prep for it. Build it into the budget, make that part of your norm. And if you are falling just a little short of that payment next month, that's okay. There's no consequence for missing it, but there will be if you miss it in August or September when payments are going again, or at least we think they are. So give yourself time to work this new payment or payment back into your life, back into your budget, and work on it soon.
Yep. I think that's some great solid advice. It's been a long time since people have had to think about this student loan payment. So it's going to be a rude awakening for some that are not prepared, but that's not anyone listening to this. You guys are prepared. Well, thank you guys for listening in with us today, and shoot your questions to help@studentloanplanner.com. Schedule a consultation with us if you want some customized help with your student loan plan. There's a lot of things coming up that we could talk about and help you pivot around, and we'll talk about timing, taxes in regards to student loans, your student loan plan, what the new repay plan could look like compared to your current path. Lots of exciting stuff that we could review on our consultations right now, even though we don't know the exact details of everything quite yet, but we're getting close. But thanks, Dan, for joining me today.
Thank you, Megan. Thanks, everybody. Take care.